It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf's latest round of coronavirus restrictions lifted yesterday at 8 a.m. In a statement, he said the mitigation efforts did their job, reducing a rise in coronavirus cases after the holidays. Indoor dining is allowed to resume, along with a number of other activities. But what about employees and businesses severely affected by these efforts? Today we're speaking with Amanda Schaffner, a bartender at D'Anoia's Eatery. She's also president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild. Amanda, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, Amanda, when was the last time you worked behind the bar?
I was actually brought back to work for one day last week for New Year's Eve pickups.
Now, you've been on furlough since mid-November, I believe, and you helped make meal kits for your restaurant over the summer. Having been on furlough, what has that been like for somebody who's used to working?
I am someone who likes to keep busy, and so it's been frustrating to, you know, have to sit still and, like, just deal with being unemployed or, like, look for a job. And on the other side of that, unemployment has certainly been a challenge because I hadn't claimed anything since the beginning of the pandemic. I went back to work pretty early, helping out with the meal kits, as you mentioned. It took me 5 weeks to get somebody from the unemployment office to speak with me and understand why all of a sudden I was claiming full benefits again.
And so you were without any income, revenue at all for those days, for those 4 weeks?
Correct. I was fortunate enough that I have savings, but I know for many people in this industry that might not always be the situation. I don't have dependents. I don't have children. So what savings I have, I'm able to make work for me. Mm.
The restrictions on indoor dining were lifted yesterday. So now restaurants can operate with limited capacity, 50% if they do the online certification, 25% capacity otherwise. Have you returned to work? If not, do you expect to return soon?
I have not returned to work. I'm hoping to return soon, but I know a lot of places are probably going to opt for the option of sticking to takeout for a while, because despite the restrictions being lowered, the numbers are still fairly high. And in addition to that, 50% is not really economically sustainable.
Right. And the economic decision is, do we want to open for 50% capacity? But also, how many members of our staff we can afford to bring back?
You know, it's how many staff can we bring back? How many staff want to come back? There's a large number of people right now that are, you know, looking into career changes, and can I sustain this roller coaster ride for, you know, 6, 8, 12 more months, you know?
You're also president of the Pittsburgh chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild. What are you hearing from your members right now?
I've definitely heard some people changing careers, or even temporarily changing careers with the intention to hopefully return. I'm hearing about frustrations with unemployment. That's a big one. I'm hearing about people that need help. Some people are okay, and some people are struggling.
So we're in a new year, multiple approved vaccines. People are talking about a return to normal, whatever that means, within the year. Are you optimistic that's going to happen?
I'm optimistic because I have to be. Like, I want very badly for things to return to a better version of what we considered normal. What I'm seeing discussed within the industry right now is, why should we return to the way things were? Things like pay inequality and the hours that people in this industry work and the working conditions and the things that were not so great about the restaurant industry. Those are the things that I think a lot of people right now are questioning. Why should we return to that?
So March will mark 1 year since the original lockdown and the initial restrictions. If you try to imagine it, where do you see yourself in a couple of months?
I think I'll still be working in a restaurant that's not operating like a regular restaurant, to be honest. I'm expecting things to be as they are now until at least May or June, when outdoor dining can be reasonable again. And I personally think that it won't be until towards the end of the year, if we even get close to resuming full operations in restaurants. But I'm not an epidemiologist or doctor, so I, you know, this is just my prediction, I guess.
Right. Amanda Schaffner is a bartender here in Pittsburgh and president of the local chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Major League Baseball decided that 3,400 players from seven former Negro Leagues should be considered to be major leaguers. This decision comes 73 years after Jackie Robinson broke Major League Baseball's color barrier. Rob Ruck is a history professor at the University of Pittsburgh and sports historian. He's the author of several books, including Raceball, How the Major Leagues Colonized the Black and Latin Game, and Sandlot Season, Sport in Black Pittsburgh. Rob, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to hear from you.
Rob, you know, Major League Baseball has had opportunities to do this before, so why did it take so long to recognize these players as major leaguers?
I have found that Major League Baseball responds when it's embarrassed. And there have been a couple of turning points in its attitudes and public stance towards race. But I think what really was the catalyst this time was the response from athletes across the country and from people in the wake of George Floyd's murder. And Major League Baseball, which has always been a little late to the party, finally realized it had to do something.
Pittsburgh had two Negro Leagues teams, Pittsburgh Crawfords and the Homestead Grays. You've written about them. Two in one city, and two very successful ones in one city. Was that common, uncommon?
Pittsburgh is probably the only city that had two Negro League teams. Certainly teams of the caliber of the Homestead Grays and the Pittsburgh Crawfords. Both emerged from the city's sandlots. The Homestead Grays were a bunch of skilled black steelworkers in the early 20th century across the Monongahela River in Homestead. And the Crawfords were the sons of the Great Migration, who got their name from the Crawford bathhouse on the hill. Those two teams had some of the best, most astute, and in some ways best capitalized leadership in black baseball.
So Major League Baseball is welcoming all these players, but will they accept the stats? I mean, it's said that Josh Gibson hit more than 800 homers. That would put him number one all time.
I'm not sure what the statistical records are going to reveal. Certainly Gibson hit hundreds and hundreds of home runs all over the United States and the Caribbean. The question that the record keepers are going to have to determine is how many of those were hit in Negro League play versus against a semi-pro barnstorming team, or even in Mexico, Cuba, and the Dominican Republic. When you just look at Negro League records, you're going to see those numbers are much smaller than overall records, because black teams, in order to keep afloat financially, often play two or three games a day. Only perhaps a third of all the games they played each season were against other black Negro League teams.
The integration of baseball meant best players often left these teams if they could find a Major League Baseball team to sign them. What did Dad eventually do to the Negro Leagues?
The Negro Leagues were essentially sacrificed on the altar of integration. When Major League teams integrated, and remember that most were really quite opposed to that happening, but when they saw Robinson's success, other teams slowly fell into line. But they took the best young black players like Mays, Aaron, Banks, Campanella. And they took a few of the older players like Satchel Paige and Monty Irvin. Most black players, however, lost their jobs because the Negro Leagues could not withstand integration, because integration meant that black fans were going to major league games now and not attending Negro League games. Buck Leonard, the Hall of Famer who played 17 years for the Homestead Grey, said, after integration, we couldn't draw flies. And Major League Baseball does not answer a request by the Negro Leagues to be made a high minor league. And there's simply no integration of front offices, managers, coaches. In many cases, black teams did not receive compensation for the players who entered Major League Baseball. And the National Negro League collapsed after the 1948 season. The Negro American League played on a bit into the 50s, but it was a pallid version of what it once had been.
In 1990, the Negro League Hall of Fame opened. I had the pleasure to talk with an all-time great, Buck O'Neill. He was instrumental in creating that hall. He's not in the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown. About how many former Negro League stars are in the hall, Rob?
I think about 35. Buck O'Neill should have been among them.
So do you think that this acceptance by Major League Baseball might lead to a reconsideration of Buck O'Neill, and might it lead to more inductions of former Negro League players?
I think it'd be wonderful if the Hall of Fame would hold another special committee election for players from black baseball in the Caribbean. I think it's even more important, though, that Major League Baseball, which is wildly profitable, pandemic aside for a moment, put more of its profit back into underserved communities and invest in the social capital that sport brings those communities. I think it can do the symbolic action that ought to be done, but I'd like to see it put its money where its mouth is.
Rob Rock is a history professor at the University of Pittsburgh and sports historian. He's the author of several books, including Raceball, How the Major Leagues Colonized the Black and Latin Game. Rob, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. State data show that COVID-19 hospitalizations in Pennsylvania have increased by more than 500% since the beginning of November. But administrators of the state's largest hospital system say that staff are capable of handling the significant influx of patients. At a December 8th news conference, UPMC Senior Vice President Leslie Davis said despite the increase, there's a, quote, calm feeling across the system.
There is no need to feel nervous or anxious. We are not overwhelmed with this virus.
Jody Fulton cares for COVID-19 patients in the intensive care unit at UPMC Shadyside. In a recent letter to the editor of the Tribune Review, she disagreed with Davis's characterization. Fulton talked with 90.5 WESA's health and science reporter Sarah Bowden outside from a safe distance about what it's like to care for COVID patients during this ongoing surge.
Jody, UPMC's Leslie Davis made these comments on December 8th. What was it like to be an ICU nurse in early December?
In early December, it had gotten pretty bad. Everyone in my ICU and others were working overtime. We had opened up a makeshift ICU for COVID patients outside of the emergency department. And we were all asked to give up one nurse from each ICU to staff that new ICU. These rooms are not made for ICU patients. The doors don't even close all the way, and we're expected to have this tight infection control, and we weren't able to maintain any of the things that we had been used to as nurses taking care of these patients in any other ICU.
So when you heard Ms. Davis make these comments, what was your reaction?
I was appalled. I'm pretty protective over a lot of the nurses that I work with. A lot of them are younger than me, and a lot of them felt the same way that I did too, but everyone was afraid to say anything.
So state data shows that hospitalizations have started to decline a bit, especially this last week or so of December. And UPMC says only about a quarter of COVID patients are sick enough to be sent to the ICU. So have things gotten better?
I will say that we've had a few more open beds, but we've also had a lot of people pass away that make for those empty beds.
How does caring for a COVID patient differ from a non-COVID patient in the ICU?
It's hard because we have to keep the doors closed. It's very lonely for the patients if they're alert enough to know what's going on. It's hard if an alarm is going off, if something is happening with the patient, you can't just rush in. You have to put your mask on, you have to put the gloves on, your goggles, your gown, and it takes a lot more of your shift just trying to keep yourself safe.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that COVID patients are dying at higher volumes than other ICU patients. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So how does that affect you emotionally and mentally?
It's hard because usually on our unit, at least, we would have a death maybe every few weeks. Every month we would have a few people pass away. But now it's multiple times a week. You're taking someone to the morgue. You're talking to a family saying that there's nothing else that we can do, that we're going to make them as comfortable as we can. And there's no time in between each death to kind of collect yourself and mourn for that person that you may have become connected to in some way.
What's something that you experienced at work that you wish more people knew about?
I think just that it's not just the nurses that are overwhelmed, it's the physicians too who have been picking up extra shifts, who are covering every ICU in the hospital, tending to every emergency that happens throughout the hospital. And sometimes things will happen, like when we had a patient who was crashing. I was stuck in the room with this patient by myself waiting for a physician to come for over a half hour. And I want people to know that it's something that could happen, not just to a COVID patient, to any patient in the hospital. We're stretched so thin, and we want to provide the best, most compassionate care that we can. And it's hard when there aren't enough hours in the day and there aren't enough of us.
Thank you so much for sharing this with me. And I'm sorry you're going through this right now.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Jody Fulton is an ICU nurse at UPMC Shadyside. She spoke with WESA's Sarah Bowden. A spokesperson for UPMC says they have no report that Fulton waited more than a half an hour for a doctor to respond to an emergency. She added the health system staffing levels are meeting demands of the COVID surge and that the medical system recognizes this is, quote, a stressful and very challenging time for our dedicated caregivers. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Tom Hurley, Isabel Schmaler, Lara Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.